I'm Rebecca Lavoie, filling in this week for John Cryer as the host of The Undisclosed Addendum. I'm a journalist and the co-author of several true crime books and the host of the podcasts Crime Writers On, These Are Their Stories, the Law and Order podcast, and HGTV and Me. I also work with The Undisclosed team on the production of their Monday episodes. And on Addendum this week, we are joined by one of my favorite journalists and podcasters, Bill Rankin. He covers criminal justice, legal affairs, and courts for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. But you may know him as host of the Breakdown podcast, which recently launched its sixth season. I love Breakdown because it focuses on breakdowns in the criminal justice system, but it's also broken some ground itself by covering cases in real time in the courts, which has been really interesting to listen to. Breakdown's current season covers a double homicide in a Northwest Atlanta Burger King in 2016. Bill, I feel like I know your voice so well. It's so great to be able to talk to you on this show.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
And Colin Miller is with us, too. He's an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law. He blogs at Evidence Prof Blog. And of course, listeners to my shows know that my favorite nickname for him is Legal Siri. Hello, Colin.
Hey, Rebecca. Always good to talk to you.
And Susan Simpson is here. She's a D.C.-based attorney. She also blogs at The View from LL2 and co-hosts the 45th podcast. Hi, Susan. How are you doing?
Hey, Rebecca. I'm great.
Now, before we get started, you announced in this week's episode that you were taking some time off from the show. So I'm wondering, when we come back with the Terrence Lewis case in a few weeks, what might we hear? Can you give us any kind of hint about that?
Well, we're still wondering, too. We'll get some more time to work on the case and check out some stuff that we didn't have to do before that we started airing.
All right. So you're going to be doing some Nancy Drewing, it sounds like, in your...
Yes. No Hardy Boying.
You're right. I'm sorry. That was very gender normative of me. Well, in this week's episode of Undisclosed, it was called Bootstrap Paradox. The team covered three aspects of the Terrence Lewis case. First, the way that Lena Laws, also known as Star, ID'd Terrence Lewis as one of the young men involved in the death of Bernard Howard. And second, how the two other men convicted in connection with that crime, as well as witness Kizzy Baker, have all said that Terrence Lewis is innocent. And third, how, based on the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996, a.k.a. the AEDPA, none of this evidence of innocence matters. It doesn't even matter that a judge said that she believed he was innocent. So a lot to unpack there. Bill, I'm just going to throw it to you for a quick response on that.
This is an amazing case, and it's disturbing in so many ways. I think y'all have done a great job exposing it, and I can't wait to see what happens.
Now, Bill, in terms of that, season four of Breakdown, Murder Below the Gnat Line, you covered a similar case where innocence might not be enough. What can you tell us about that case, Devanya Inman?
Well, Devanya Inman was a young guy who was accused and convicted of killing a woman as she closed down a Taco Bell one night in the small town of Adel, Georgia. It's kind of like South Georgia. It straddles I-75. Police said that he committed the armed robbery to take about $1,700 that was going to be deposited into the bank. So Devanya was tried and convicted of murder. There was absolutely no physical evidence against him. And since his trial, several key witnesses have come forward to say what they said at trial wasn't true. And what they said at trial was incredibly incriminatory. And years later, the Georgia Innocence Project got involved and found DNA evidence, and that while it didn't completely exonerate Devanya, it sure raised serious questions about the case. I think it pretty much blew the state's theory of the case out of the water. But yet, like Terrence Lewis, Devanya Inman still sits in prison today, and his most recent attempt to get a new trial was denied by a state court judge. He issued an opinion that the Georgia Supreme Court declined to even consider, which stunned me. So it's safe to say this case confounds me, just like the Terrence Lewis case does.
Yeah. Susan and Colin, did you follow the Devanya Inman case as well?
Yeah, I think about it a lot because I think it's the first one I really encountered. Just talking with Claire, I talked about with her ages ago now, about how evidence of innocence is such a... I mean, the idea that no matter what you find, the state can just reinvent the whole story. And we've seen that in every case to some degree. I mean, with the Nance case, they can always reinvent it. In every case, they can do that. But in this case, it was a black and white example of how if you find contradicting evidence, you can just change the whole script and say, oh, yeah, they're still guilty.
Yeah. I mean, it's really something to me that this is seems to be a quirk of the justice system in particular. I mean, if you think about even the way you behave at different kinds of jobs, I mean, we're not talking about being judges and prosecutors here, but like in my job as a journalist in a newsroom or anywhere, if you do something and you're on the record as having done something, you can't walk it back without there being repercussions of some kind. And it just it seems stunning to me that a person could just look at the actual evidence and just decide because of process, because of quirks of the law, that somebody can just be in prison indefinitely. It's really something. And I've learned a lot about how that works from listening to both the Lewis case and then also in that season of Breakdown. Colin, what was the reason for the passage of the AEDPA? How long has it been and how has it been received?
Yeah, so that was passed in 1996. It was sort of twofold reasons for its passage. One sort of the biggest attention-grabbing headline was the Oklahoma City bombing and Timothy McVeigh. And basically the people who pushed that bill said, look, we have this federal writ of habeas corpus, and the way that the federal system is currently set up, he could spend decades appealing his conviction before eventually being executed. And so that was the big push on that front to say we need to limit federal appeals. And the other part of it is it was the Republican takeover of Congress in 1994, and that sent a message to Bill Clinton, I need to move more toward the center and even the right in criminal justice. And as a big result of that, he was a proponent of the AEDPA. And so sort of those two combined effects, the Oklahoma City bombing as well as Clinton trying to be elected in 1996. In terms of the response, pretty much across the board, it's been criticized. One person called it sort of the atomic bomb of the criminal justice system. One study showed it has basically reduced the overturning of death penalty cases by 40%. And it's exactly cases like the Terrence Lewis case where you can look at it and see a real impact where, again, actual innocence used to be enough. And now we're in a situation where you can have loads of evidence of actual innocence, and it's not necessarily enough for this person to be released.
Hmm. You know, I also think about the fact that on every, you know, pop culture imagination of legal cases, that is always the magic bullet, right? When somebody else is found to have done it, or when there's DNA, or when there's exonerating evidence, like you see the next scene cut to the person walking out of prison, and it's just not happening.
It's always so quick. It's too, it's like the whole episode, they're like trying to find evidence of innocence, and then they find it. Next cut, man's walking out of prison.
Right.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, yeah, speaking of the, you know, Bill, with your case, I mean, there is viable evidence, this DNA evidence of an alternate suspect, and yet that hasn't led to any sort of relief for Inman yet, right?
Not at all. It's, he has a big law firm in Atlanta who's now representing him for free. They're trying to get back into court, but I think he has very limited chances.
It's not about innocence at all at this point. It's about whether or not you can legally force the state's hand and like deny them every possible chance to keep you in prison.
In that case, I even talked to one of the jurors who sentenced him, you know, convicted him of murder. He's serving life in prison without parole. And the juror said he should get a new trial because of all this, because he didn't know all this. And the sisters of the victim are terribly concerned that the wrong man might be in prison.
I have a digression, a little podcast pitch for somebody on this panel to think about, like well-intentioned laws that have just turned around and completely messed everything up, because it seems like this was a well-intentioned idea, right? I mean, especially it was very much of its time. It was very much,
I don't know, the name alone is pretty sinister sounding to me.
It is true, but if you think about like when these things happen, I mean, think about like, you know, the sex offender registry, for instance. When it happens, the idea is, you know, we'll be able to do better for victims, etc. There's usually some rhetoric around it that at least seems positive or seems well-intentioned. I can't think of a big criminal justice reform that has happened in my lifetime that has not ended up disenfranchising a huge population of people. I don't know. Is there one that has worked? Can anybody think of one in terms of like legislative criminal justice reform that's had a positive effect?
Well, here in Georgia, they've been led by the Republican governor. They've been scaling back strict sentences for some offenders and diverting them into accountability courts like drug courts. So that would be one. It was, and that's happened across the country. But as far as our Congress, that's another story.
Right. It's really being led by the states, I think, any kind of reform at all.
Yeah.
The holidays are fast approaching, and now you can order gifts for everyone on your list with just the click of a mouse. Let me tell you about Omaha Steaks and how for only $49.99, you can get my family gift pack when you go to omahasteaks.com and enter my code UA in the search bar. That's 75% off. Omaha Steaks offers unique gifts for gourmet food lovers. Over 500 gourmet gift ideas, and that includes pretty much anything you could want. The most flavorful tender-aged beef, plus seafood, poultry, pork, veal, lamb, and veggies. Now, I can say I've been giving Omaha Steaks as gifts for over a decade, and I plan to do so again this year. Everyone always tells me how easy the food is to make and how delicious it tastes. And right now, Omaha Steaks is giving exclusive savings just to my listeners. Listen to everything you'll get for less than $50. Two filet mignons, two top sirloins, two boneless pork chops, two boneless chicken breasts, four kielbasa sausages, four burgers, four potatoes au gratin, four caramel apple tartlets, one Omaha Steak seasoning packet, plus you get four additional kielbasa sausages for free. So go to omahasteaks.com, enter my code UA in the search bar, and get a 75% savings. It's the gift guaranteed to be a hit.
Let's go back to this week's episode. It focuses on Starr's eyewitness identification of Terrace Lewis for the murder. Susan, you tweeted something about this after the episode. Why do you find the identification in this case so troubling? And tell us what you tweeted.
Well, even aside from this particular case, the idea they've used the lineup they used here in any case at all is horrific. The lineup they have is crappy, beyond crappy. Have you seen it, Rebecca?
Yeah, it's basically four photos, right?
It's actually eight photos, but they're all really tiny.
Right.
You can't even see the faces of half of them.
Right.
And I did the experiment, sort of. So basically, there's only, to my eye, there's only one person on the whole sheet that could even remotely fit the description of Terrace Lewis. And I asked Twitter who they'd choose if, you know, if the police wanted you to choose someone, who would you pick out? And basically all of them, with a few exceptions, said number seven, Terrace Lewis.
Right, because the police were talking, you know, they sort of had a profile of the eyewitness ID of the suspect being a light-skinned, young African-American man. And then they showed this array. And there was only one light-skinned man in the array, right?
Yeah, only one. I mean, they're all clearly boys. They all look like they're about, you know, some of them could be 12 or even. They look so young.
Right.
But 17 be the very oldest, even though supposedly the people involved in the murder were like 18 to 21-year-olds.
Yeah.
But what I thought was interesting was not only did Denise Williams, the other female witness in the case, not only did she pick out seven as Terrace Lewis, she found two more photos in that eight-photo lineup to match the other two assailants.
Hmm.
Even though they don't remotely fit.
Hmm. Now, Bill, in Breakdown, you referenced the John Jerome White case as a case illustrating some of the problems with eyewitness identification. What happened in that case?
That's a pretty amazing story. So that involved the rape of an elderly woman in a town south of Atlanta about four decades ago. So that was before DNA testing was available. So police suspected that John Jerome White was the culprit. So they showed the victim a photo of him, and she said, yes, that's the guy. So that's incredibly suggestive right off the bat. They showed her a single photo. So then she was taken to the local jail where White and four fellow inmates were told to stand up in front of her so she could see if she could pick out who did it. You know, they got the usual suspects along with John Jerome White. So she stands there and she points to John Jerome White. They charge him with rape and assault. She testified at trial. She was asked eight times if it was him, and she looked over and said, yes, it was him. I guess it's important to note that she was not wearing her glasses during the attack. So, again, the Georgia Innocence Project got involved, and years later they got the DNA kit, and the DNA cleared White of being the actual rapist. He had served 22 years in prison. What's amazing, though, is that the DNA test found that one of the guys standing next to White at the jail that day was the guy who actually raped the woman. And what's also disturbing is that the same man, 6 years later, raped another woman.
Hmm. That's unbelievable.
It is.
I think we've talked on the podcast too, Susan, about, you know, police using witness identifications as a way to leverage people that are, you know, frequently kind of in trouble with the law, or that are somebody they feel they can just pull over and say, point to one of these photos. I mean, that's something that we hear happens. I don't want to say a lot, but it has happened. And it seems like Georgia is a place where this has happened quite a bit. One of the things that's very interesting to me about the cases you guys have been dealing with recently on Undisclosed is the fact that they are taken out of a state where, you know, a northerner like me imagines, oh, these things happen all the time just because we listen to so many podcasts like yours. And now we're in Pennsylvania, which has its own huge set of issues. And I think it's really interesting that you guys are focusing on that area and unpacking many of the issues in that state and with the prosecutions in that state. But with regard to eyewitness identifications, Colin, New Hampshire is actually one of the best states in addressing some of these issues. And there was a recent article about it because of some recent changes. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, and so this is something where the Innocence Project has revealed that eyewitness misidentification is a huge factor in wrongful convictions. And that's led to a number of organizations, and you can sort of look at them and say, well, some are scientific. We have the National Academy of Sciences, but then also we even have the International Association of Chiefs of Police. And they've recommended these best practices that apply for eyewitness identification. And right, New Hampshire and really most of New England has adopted these procedures, which I think are very helpful and in a case like Terrence Lewis would have helped. And so to the point of what Susan tweeted, it says in terms of fillers, in other words, people who we think are not the suspect in the crime, there have to be at least five fillers, which of course there were seven fillers in the Terrence Lewis case. But in this case, it says no filler should stand out. The filler should all resemble the witness's original description of the offender. And that we saw in both Willie Vesey and Terrence Lewis, where in terms of the skin color and the skin tone, this was a case where both men are relatively light-skinned, and they stood out among these photo arrays among men with much darker skin. And then some of the other things that are in play in terms of the protocol are a confidence statement that's getting a verbatim statement of the eyewitness at the time of identification saying how confident they are in the identification. It's double blind, making sure both the officer doing the photo array or the lineup doesn't know who the suspect is so that we don't have sort of signaling to the eyewitness. And then importantly, going to the point that Bill just mentioned and Susan mentioned in terms of identifying the other two accomplices, even though they're clearly not in the photo array, is making sure to tell the eyewitness, look, this is a case where the perpetrator of the crime might very well not be in this lineup or this array, because there's a big tendency when you don't have that instruction for a person to sort of pick the least worst option, and that can lead to a lot of false misidentifications.
And the double blind one especially is so important. I think more than anything else, that one you need.
I think the Innocence Project has shown that I think about 75% of their exonerations have come from misidentifications.
Yeah.
Well, it's one of the reasons why, frankly, we only write true crime books focusing on New Hampshire cases. I have to say, you know, our issues with the justice system here have more to do with like funding of the prison system, for instance. But I have to say the bar is very, very high here for getting arrested for a murder. I know some people in the AG's office. We know a lot of cops just from our work reporting these. And, you know, there are many cases where a cop will tell you in confidence they know who did it, but there isn't enough because the bar is so high. The Assistant Attorney General, Jeff Strelzin, in charge of the homicide unit here, once told me that they aren't well funded enough to go to trial with the wrong person. So they wait, they say, until they have 110% of what they believe they would need to secure a conviction. And as a result, you know, I think that there have been some good reforms in the state that have, you know, been shaped by that. But at the same time, it just seems like not a difficult protocol to put in place and one that everybody should have. So I don't know. Of course, doing it now wouldn't retroactively help any of these folks because of this federal law. So it's kind of a conundrum. Now, Colin, part of the episode this week also dealt with attorney-client privilege and how, despite one of Terrence Lewis's alleged accomplices telling his attorney that Terrence was involved in the murder, that attorney, the one for the accomplice, couldn't do anything. Could you unpack that a little bit for us?
Yeah, so this is something that I've always found fascinating about confidentiality and attorney-client privilege, and that is there are certain exceptions, and one of the main exceptions is the future crimes exception. If a client tells his attorney, I'm going to murder this prospective witness, then that attorney has to report that, of course, because there's preventable harm. And the question is, what if we have a case like the Terrence Lewis case or a similar case where a client tells an attorney, look, there's this other guy who either is on trial now, about to be on trial, or has already been convicted for a crime, and I'm the person who committed it, or in the Terrence Lewis case, I was one of the perpetrators and Terrence Lewis was not one of them. And what essentially all jurisdictions say is, well, that's different. That's not a future crime, and therefore the attorney not only doesn't have to disclose, but in fact can't disclose. And there's in effect sort of two different ethical rules that apply in about half of states. One, there's been a change that says an attorney can report what a client tells him or her if it has the ability to prevent substantial bodily harm. And when they amended this, sort of the example they gave was a client saying, maybe a corporate client, we dumped toxic waste into water. And the concern is in the future, that's going to cause harm to the citizens of this city or this county. And so that is now allowed. And then there's other jurisdictions that don't have it that way, but still have this future crime exception. And the point in the essay that I wrote in this was to say, well, a case of a wrongful conviction or certainly a death penalty case is a case where there's culpable conduct by the client. They're admitting to committing a crime and there's preventable harm, and it's serious bodily harm, because incarceration based upon communicable disease, the lack of health care, violence in prison, same-sex sexual assault, all these issues. My point is to say that states should create this exception that allows an attorney to come forward and say, my client confessed to a crime and said this other guy is innocent. So far, it's been a tough sell. Massachusetts has an exception. Alaska has an exception. But most states say, no, this is a case where the attorney is not allowed to make the disclosure.
Yeah, I'm torn on this one. And this is a good case of a good example of why it'd be so dangerous to waive attorney-client privilege. I mean, this is the fact that JR came forward and said this is a big deal for his case. He has definitely harmed his chances in the future. And if he'd done it before trial, he would have just basically thrown away a chance he ever had of freedom again. So as an attorney, I would not want to have to give that sort of stuff away, especially when there's still a chance that you can defeat a really flimsy case for all the defendants involved.
It's interesting. You know, I understand in the Gladden case, I've never come across this in covering courts, but I found it fascinating. It made me think of all these co-defendant cases I've had, where, especially in a death penalty case where the cases are tried separately, this kind of stuff must happen all the time with attorneys knowing more than they can disclose. It's really something.
Yeah, and I actually, each year I Skype into a class at Susan's alma mater, George Washington. There's actually an adjunct professor who works for the Mid-Atlantic Innocence Project, and he has his students read the essay that I wrote. And he said, when he talked to me, I expected when I presented this to the class that 100% of the students are going to support your proposal. And we find every single year when I Skype into the class and he's teaching it, is it's pretty split, 50-50. Half the students say, oh, absolutely, we can't have a case of a person in prison for decades when we have this confession out there. And the other half, as Susan said, this is a reason we have attorney-client privilege. You need to feel safe in communicating to your attorney anything and everything about your case. And the more exceptions we start adding into this confidentiality, that takes away from effective representation. So it is a tough issue. I acknowledge that it's not something that's a slam dunk.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, it makes me feel really torn too. It's one of those things that could be well-intentioned and put into place and then used to, you know, screw people later, for lack of a better way of putting it. I mean, it could be another example of that. I mean, it's too bad there's no way to, you know, for attorneys, and I know this is not possible with the system we have, but to be able to file, you know, confidential briefs in cases that are somehow shielded. You know, you think about the rape shield law, you think about laws that shield minors and any disclosures about minors in cases. And it's really too bad that there's no way to protect, you know, the other defendant, the one who can exonerate someone, and his legal process or her legal process, and file something that's shielded.
We sort of do, and I've kind of wondered before, sort of like a proffer thing could be invoked here. So sometimes for cases, you can have situations where, like, you know, queen for the day, where you're off, you talk to the prosecutor, you can tell them stuff, as long as you're truthful, they can't use that against you ever. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the attorneys can do that as well, where they're going to be informally to the prosecution, like, look, if we were going to make a deal, here's what it would say theoretically. And that, again, can't ever be used. And I guess possibly a situation could be done where it worked out that way. So in this case, JR's attorney could go to the prosecutor and say, look, hypothetically, if one of the guys was there, he would say that Terrence Lewis actually wasn't at the place and you should re-look at this case. Mm. So I guess maybe that'd be the way to go.
Who was the guy you mentioned, Colin, and as your example when you were going through this?
Yeah, the case, it's an interesting one, is Alton Logan. And that was a case, I think, 2008 in Chicago. I was actually teaching at a law school in Chicago when 60 Minutes did this story on his case. And we did a program at the law school where the public defenders who took the confession and then kept it under wraps for the 26 or 27 years talked to the students and some attorneys in the area. And once again, it was very much a split where the public defenders were saying, look, we take this oath and this is a cherished oath and we could not betray our client's confidences until after he died because that was the agreement. And a lot of people in the audience gave them a ton of flack and said, how do you live with yourself? How do you sleep at night? And then other people gave the other side a lot of flack and said, look, this is the oath you take as an attorney and you can't betray your client's confidences. And I do wish, Rebecca, as you say, there were some type of solution that could keep the wrongfully convicted out of prison and at the same time keep the sanctity of attorney-client privilege.
Well, also you had that great audio clip from Mr. Logan himself, who essentially was saying, how can you live with yourself? Because he had been spending decades in prison. That was it's so sad.
It is sad. I mean, if you think about, you know, you've probably all visited people in prison, right, through the course of your work. And I think it's not easy for people to understand what it means to be in prison for an interminable period of time. And then to add to that this idea that you shouldn't be there. It's really something. It's really difficult, I think, to wrap your head around. And, you know, in my limited time, you know, visiting people in prison for the reporting that we've done for our books, tiny freedoms, you know, not being able to eat what you want, not being able to have the warm coat that you want when it's cold out, not being able to make a phone call when you want. I mean, it adds up, even if you are happen to be in a nice facility that has, you know, decent programming. All those tiny freedoms being away add up. And it's something that I can't even, as the young people say, think about. And I don't think a lot of people can really understand with the consequences, what it really means. But now, Colin, you did mention that Terrence was given a sentence of life without parole and that Philadelphia leads the country in juvenile lifers. On your blog, you've also been doing posts about the Santoya Brown case. What can you tell us about that case?
Yeah, this is something that a lot of people have been tweeting and writing about. I think there was a documentary done a few years ago, but she essentially was a minor. She was 16 years old. She had a childhood that involved a lot of abuse. She was sexually assaulted. She was forced into prostitution by a pimp, and she ended up killing one of the clients. And there's a question of whether it was self-defense or not. But that's not really my focus on whether she's innocent or guilty of the crime. The focus is we had this 2012 Supreme Court opinion in Miller versus Alabama, and it said you can't have a mandatory sentence of life without parole for juveniles. Their brains aren't sufficiently developed, and they have to be given an individualized hearing to determine whether they should be eligible for parole. And the way it's sort of broken down, some states already had it before, many afterwards. About half of states say, just period, you can't have a sentence of life without parole for a juvenile. And then about the other half of states have various rules, but generally there's eligibility for parole between about 20 and 30 years into a sentence. Tennessee, as this case is illustrated, has, I think, and I've almost done my research in all 50 states, the harshest, which is to say in Tennessee, a juvenile homicide offender like Santoya Brown is not eligible for parole until serving 51 years of their sentence. And I actually just saw this morning there's a representative in Tennessee who is proposing to lower that rule, and so I'm hoping to work with her and maybe have her on the podcast. But the point here is to say, not necessarily that a person would get released early, it's just to say, let's have the option. If you have a case like this where there's clear evidence of abuse, and this is a case where she's now graduated from college, she's working on advanced degrees, let's at least give people in a state like Tennessee a chance to demonstrate they can be paroled before serving 51 years of a sentence where they're going to be a senior citizen and they've spent the vast majority of their life in prison.
Hmm. Now, Colin, something else you've been writing about is wrongful conviction compensation bills. Bill, you covered this in Georgia in the case of Latham Ward. Is that right? Or Latham Ward?
Yes.
Latham
that's
Ward.
Right.
Okay.
You're right.
Can you talk about that case a little bit?
Sure. Well, Georgia is still, I've read that story a few years ago, is Georgia still one of several states with no method of calculating compensation for someone who spent years in prison but was found to be wrongly convicted. In Georgia, you essentially have to get a legislator to sponsor a bill for you to get money. Latham Ward spent 12 years in prison for armed robbery, and he didn't commit it, and he got the local legislator to sponsor a compensation bill. The legislature finally agreed to give him $400,000, and they came up with that figure by calculating how much he would have earned if he had been a Marine, because he was supposed to report to basic training not long after he was arrested, so he never got to do that. So they said, well, if you went to the Marines for 12 years, you would have made about $400,000, so here's your $400,000. And that kind of struck me as an odd way to figure out that compensation, because, you know, losing your freedom for more than a decade probably ought to factor in too.
Well, and future earnings as well, because if he had been a Marine, right, his prospects for future employment would probably be a lot greater than his prospects for future employment are when you've been in prison wrongfully, right?
Yes. And also, yes, absolutely. I mean, also, John Jerome White, the guy we talked about earlier, he spent 22 years in prison before he was exonerated. He was given $500,000. So there's really no rhyme or reason. And sometimes it's staggered. It's a staggered payment. It's not a lump sum. And one of the first Georgia exonerees, Clarence Harrison, I talked to him recently. There are a lot of exonerees who are really struggling in Georgia. So hopefully, I think I'm going to keep writing about it. Maybe the legislature will do something.
Colin, what have you been working on this front?
Yeah, this is something actually I just this weekend passed along to a legislator here in South Carolina, and I think we're going to get it co-sponsored here. But 32 states, D.C., and the federal government have laws that allow for wrongfully convicted individuals to get compensation. As Bill just said, Georgia is not one of those. South Carolina is not one of those. But I had a student actually who was on the podcast when I was discussing the Jamar Huggins case, Chelsea Evans, and she wrote an article on it. I've gone through and looked at all the different states and what they do and sort of drafted a proposed bill. And so we're hoping in South Carolina to get something passed in this next legislative session that would give a mechanism to give compensation to the wrongfully convicted.
And it's worth noting this is just not just about the exonerees themselves and helping them, which, again, is an important goal here. But also there are so few consequences in general for wrongful convictions that that having a serious monetary penalty is kind of the only deterrent there is in many cases.
Right.
In some jurisdictions, they've had so many wrongful convictions that this is actually a financial strain on them.
Right.
And that will be something going forward that will stop their prosecutors, stop their cops from doing this. Because the people involved themselves almost never face consequences. But if your agency's going broke, well, that'll change your behavior.
Right. Of course, I think the famous case that I think is the one where I kind of brought this into the popular consciousness in the last couple of years, the Stephen Avery case, where, you know, he had some small compensation but was suing and then was arrested for another crime. And that basically nullified his chances of winning any more compensation. That's a complicated case, but I think that's one where, you know, this compensation issue, you know, was kind of brought into the pop culture mainstream. So we do have
and that's a rarity, but it's also worth knowing too that this whole compensation issue does affect people's ability to get free in the first place.
Right.
If someone's going to sue you for millions if they get out, that's a good reason to say no. I think they're really guilty.
Yeah, and Rebecca, speaking of that, in my research, I found, well, Wisconsin is one of the worst states in this regard. They capped the recovery at $25,000, which is part of why Avery was so low. One state, maybe a couple more, but one state is worse, and that is New Hampshire, which is caps it at $20,000. So you could be wrongfully convicted for decades in New Hampshire, and the maximum recovery under their exoneree statute is $20,000.
Do you happen to know how many convictions have been overturned here? Because I don't think there have been many. I mean, there's one that's been going on forever, a murder case here in the state, but I can't think of a murder case or a wrongful conviction case, something that's been turned over in my work since I've been working reporting on stories in New Hampshire for the last 12 years or so. I think it's exceedingly uncommon. But it's true that that is a very small amount of money, even if it were to happen. We got a few listener questions. I'd love to throw these to the panel and see what you guys think. First of all, this question's confusing. June says that she has a theory about the person who is said to have shot his gun into the ceiling actually shot into the victim's back. I'm not sure about that. But Susan, just to be clear, like, there was no gunshot into the ceiling in the Terrence Lewis case, right?
No, there was no shotgun fired at all. And the cause of death was clearly a handgun, probably 9mm,
right,
fired into the small of the back.
So where do you think that part of the story came from?
I think that Star was extremely high and not particularly coherent at the time, and her perceptions were altered. Maybe she heard some commotion, didn't see all of it, and she was filling in gaps in her own imagination, which she either assumed were true or thought they really were true.
Yeah. It sounded almost like the scene from a movie, you know, like filling in something that she had seen on TV or something to sort of fill in that gap. I don't know. We got another question from Twitter user BearDR, and this was the tweet. Ineffective assistance of PCR counsel. We heard about it in the Syed waiver story, but what is the history? Colin, do you know anything about that?
Yeah, well, this ties in again to the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. This is something some of you might have listened to a podcast Brooke Giddings did on the Richard Nicholas case, and that is the case out of Baltimore of the father who allegedly killed his daughter. And what we found in the research in that case was the AEDPA does not allow a claim in federal court of ineffective assistance of PCR counsel. And that's the current stature of the case in Terrence Lewis is exactly the federal magistrate is saying you're actually innocent and your state post-conviction counsel screwed things up by not doing a couple things. But at least in federal court, that's irrelevant because you can't claim ineffective assistance of PCR counsel. So that's not going to be a current avenue for relief.
You know, in Florida, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals here in Atlanta, they issued an opinion a couple of years ago, and they put a appendix at the end of it, and they showed how many times lawyers in Florida representing people on death row had missed the deadlines of filing appeals. So these guys were essentially screwed. And this happens all the time. And I have a question. Can I have a question?
Please.
So the AEDPA, Rosemary Barquette, who was a judge on the 11th Circuit, she once called it a thicket of procedural brambles because it's so complicated and so confusing. So I guess the question, it kind of begs the question, is justice better served by allowing appeals to progress over decades, or is it better served by enforcing rigid new guidelines for new evidence that might prevent a wrongful conviction?
Yeah, well, Bill, I know you covered the Troy Davis case, which involved a very similar factual scenario as Terrence Lewis. And so, yeah, can you share your reporting on the Troy Davis case?
Sure. A colleague of mine, Alan Judd, and I, we were the first people to write a story about these recantations of the state's witnesses. That was back in 2003. Troy Davis, anyone pretty familiar with the U.S. justice system knows about the Troy Davis case. He was sentenced to death for killing an off-duty Savannah police officer. But after the trial, 7 of 9 key prosecution witnesses recanted their testimony. And I've interviewed several of them and found them to be pretty credible. So it made me wonder, you know, if the state was right, they probably used people who were not telling the truth during the trial, or they were wrong and people who were testifying were lying. So anyway, so the case was really disturbing because it raised serious innocence questions, and his execution was stayed 3 times, which is highly unusual. For the first time in half a century, the U.S. Supreme Court stepped in and ordered an evidentiary hearing. And it's interesting, in that decision, Colin and I have talked about this, Justice Scalia issued a kind of a famous dissent, and he wrote, this court has never held that the Constitution forbids the execution of a convicted defendant who had a full and fair trial, but is later able to convince a habeas court that he is actually innocent. So Justice Scalia was saying, if you have a full and fair trial, even though you're innocent, the Constitution can't stop it. Stop your execution. So anyway, I covered that hearing, and the judge ultimately ruled against Davis, and he was executed. And his final words, he still maintained his innocence.
This is something I hear over and over again, right? So we talk about, you know, the media around true crime cases on my show. And, you know, we've obviously reported a lot on crime. But the one thing I think that comes up over and over again is, you know, a jury of his peers found, you know, he had a lawyer, he had a trial, he had his due process. And it comes up again and again. And I think it also could come up in the compensation conversation that, you know, could the jurors have known differently? Could the lawyers have known differently? But when you're talking about new evidence and you're saying, yeah, they maybe couldn't have known differently in an extreme case where something completely new came up, it's very difficult to wrap my mind around the idea that the Constitution doesn't protect somebody from being able to make their case again. It's difficult. I don't see where in the Constitution it doesn't, you know, protect that individual.
It doesn't say that anywhere. It just says that there are due process requirements, and
right,
if those are met, then what punishment follows?
Right.
I mean, is there any difference between, obviously the death penalty is much more horrific in terms of immediate consequences, but it didn't say either that you can't leave someone in prison wrongfully convicted. I mean, that's the Scalia interpretation. There are other ways of interpreting the Constitution, but it's true that under our current system, we have no guarantees that once your process was fair, that your actual state of innocence or guilt has any bearing.
Hmm.
Yeah, and from my perspective, there's a difference between successive habeas petitions based upon maybe arguments that were raised before, but in both the Davis case and the Terrence Lewis case, I mean, it's very similar. The defendants are claiming actual innocence. They're trying to use this case, schlup, this federal case, to claim we can bootstrap these waived claims. But it's the same in both, where both Terrence Lewis and Troy Davis say, my trial counsel was ineffective, and then my post-conviction counsel was ineffective by failing to raise these arguments that were issues before the trial court. And basically, as Bill just noted with Justice Scalia, and as we saw in the Terrence Lewis case this week, a judge is looking at it and saying, yes, it's possible or certain your trial counsel messed up. Yes, it's possible or certain your appellate counsel messed up. But because both of those existed, we can't give you relief even if we find you're actually innocent. And that's a real problem for me. I mean, I can understand why you would prevent successive petitions based upon things that are not fault-based. But if you're saying you're barred based upon fault by both your trial and appellate counsel, that's just saying you got screwed twice and we're going to screw you for a third time now.
But even successive petitions, I hate that. I think that needs to be rethought, because yes, there is a huge cost to the system to having these repetitive, actually frivolous appeals, and they suck to deal with. Like, as a day-to-day matter, if you're doing appellate work, you really hate seeing that pro se guy who's been in prison forever and is clearly obviously guilty, but is going to every year file something new you have to deal with every time. But at the same time, the idea that someone in prison has to know to like time their appeal or PCR at a perfect point when they have just enough evidence to get free, but not too late to miss claims or to miss deadlines or to lose their chance to file at all, that's insane. Like, I look at all these cases and I'm always like, I can't help you. You've lost your shot. Even if I found perfect evidence tomorrow of innocence, you're screwed forever.
Right.
And it puts the burden on someone who is absolutely unable to bear it.
And you're also talking about a system of judges that change. You know, some of these judges have long appointments. Some of them are elected and have shorter appointments. There are political winds that influence decisions in some of these appeals. And then sometimes they swing the other way. And the idea that a human being can say no based on process when in a different circumstance, they may have said something different, or that, you know, even if the process is fine, the human being can say no because they want to say no, and the person would be out of chances because of the process. I mean, it's a little bit, it's confounding. It is confounding to me as somebody who looks at these things largely from the outside.
What struck me in the Terrence Lewis case was you had a federal magistrate who said he was essentially innocent, but her hands were tied because his post-conviction lawyer messed up. And I was glad to read that she was troubled by it, but I read the federal appeals court decision that upheld her decision, and it was written by Judge Fuentes, and he meticulously went through her reasoning and upheld it and found that she had followed the law. There was not one single word in that opinion to say how horrible this was.
Hmm. And even her opinion, she writes, it's frustrating. Like, the understatement in that.
Yeah.
At least she said that.
Yeah.
The
true.
Third Circuit said nothing like that.
Yeah. They didn't care. Like, who cares if he's innocent? That's not what we're looking at here.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what options are left for Terrence Lewis considering the AEDPA? This is from a tweeter. Jeremy Sell sent that our way, but I'm actually curious too. Are there options? Is there anything left to go here? Like, what could happen?
We'll get into this more in later episodes, but essentially, Terrence's problem in some respects is that he has too many options, and they've kind of locked together to make a procedural quagmire. So he does have, on a few different procedural fronts, not just on innocence, he does have options. It's just going to be really hard to break through that in the next like half decade or so.
Yeah, and there's also, beyond the judicial system, there is the Conviction Review Unit, which, of course, has thrown out Sean Thomas's conviction. And with Larry Krasner coming in the new district attorney, that is going to be something where, you know, we're hoping that the Conviction Review Unit is going to take a strong look at this case, the Willie Vesey case, and that's always a possibility beyond going to the courts.
Oh, I was going to ask, that was going to be one of my questions, where are the district attorney here? You know, the district attorney is supposed to be a minister of justice, so I know they're busy. I know they have very hard jobs. I know they have to keep violent predators off the streets and keep us safe, so that's their priority, but they also need to correct an injustice when they see one. I've had cases where I thought there was an injustice and the district attorney didn't do anything still. So I guess I was going to ask you what's going on in Pennsylvania with the DA there, but they do have a new unit.
The new DA actually was on our show. He was just elected. Before his election, he talked to Rabia for the series on Sean Thomas, and he'll be incoming in January.
Well, that's helpful.
He's a defense attorney too.
That's helpful. That really is.
Yeah, I mean, people are calling him the most progressive DA of a major city in pretty much American history. So we have high hopes for not only this front of wrongful convictions, but a lot of different ways in which the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office is going to prosecute crimes.
Yeah, I mean, you just think about someone who's wrongfully convicted. I mean, it's not that much different from having someone kidnapped and locked away for decades at a time. Like the pain, the financial loss, all that is there. And again, it's embarrassing to the state, which is why they don't address it. But if you're looking to make a real difference in people's lives and to make our system more just, that's a really easy, low-hanging fruit place to start.
Yeah. I mean, I guess what we have to do is get other district attorneys and other AGs to not see it as a win or a loss, right? When the truth comes out. I think that's a big problem, is the way that these are framed as wins and losses. You know, it's considered not good when they let somebody out because then they are in error. And, you know, I think that's an attitude that probably needs to shift. Anybody have any final thoughts on the Terrence Lewis case before we wrap it up? Susan?
Not about Terrence Lewis, but I've just been thinking a lot lately about, so on our other podcast, we interviewed Dukakis. And of course, there's the whole Willie Horton issue there. And as bad as things are in the legal system, I do feel hopeful that we've come around a bit. Like Krasner, the new DA in Philly, he's not afraid of sort of the Willie Horton style attacks. He's operating, or he got elected without, you know, being afraid of being treated that way by opposition. And I'm hoping our society's come around to a place where that's less of a vulnerability for politicians, which I think will make it a lot easier to see real reform happen.
What about you, Bill? Final thoughts?
I can't wait to hear the next episode of the Terrence Lewis case.
Me neither.
In 2018.
You know, I actually edit these episodes, and the first I actually hear them is when I'm putting them together and audio, and sometimes, full disclosure, I'll be sitting at my in the studio editing, and I'll be like, Kevin, you have to come down here and listen to this part, because it's just, you know, it'll be like the oh wow moments coming over and over again. So I'm really looking forward to it too. Colin, do you have final thoughts on the Terrence Lewis case, or what's been happening, you know, in the legal atmosphere before we wrap things up?
Well, yeah, I mean, sort of, as I said, the project I'm working on now is trying to get this bill passed in South Carolina. And as I said, 32 states have these laws for compensation for the wrongfully convicted. I think Bill's podcast, our podcast, other media out there about wrongful convictions has really shined a light on this. And if you're in a state that does not have one of these laws, it's really tough for exonerees to get compensation. It's really tough for them to adjust back to normal life mentally, emotionally, income-wise. And so give a call to your state representative, and if I'll post it on my blog, sort of the list of states that have it and don't. And, you know, I think this is one of the few things in the criminal justice system that has some bipartisan support. And so let's push our state representatives to get this legislation passed in the states that don't have it.
Yeah. So, Colin, I'm assuming you're going to tweet out that link to your blog as well. So if our listeners want to find you on Twitter and see all the stuff you're tweeting out about this case and all the stuff you're working on, how can they find you there?
That's at EvidenceProf.
And Bill Rankin, if our listeners want to find you online to get your perspective on these cases and the upcoming stories you're covering on Breakdown, how can they find you on Twitter or elsewhere?
I'm at AJC Courts, at AJC Courts, or B Rankin, B-R-A-N-K-I-N, at AJC.com.
Susan Simpson, how can listeners find you online, follow the many revelations you sometimes tweet out about the stories you're working on, and get clues to your Hardy Boys investigative work?
On Twitter, I am at TheViewFromLL2, and occasionally I'll blog at TheViewFromLL2.com. And Rebecca, where can people find you for one of your many hundreds of podcasts?
My hundreds of podcasts, yes. If you want to connect with me, I am at Reb Lavoie and also at Crime Writers On. So, Bill Rankin, thanks so much for joining the panel this week. It's been really wonderful talking to you.
Likewise. Rebecca, Susan, Colin, thank you for having me. It's been great.
Sure.
And Susan and Colin, I guess we'll hear from you in January. Thanks so much for today. It was really fun.
Yes. Talk to you next year.
You can continue to follow the Terrence Lewis case by making sure to stay subscribed to the Undisclosed podcast, which returns with the rest of the series in January. Undisclosed executive producer is Mital Telhan. Audio production for Addendum is done by the very talented Hannah McCarthy. Make sure to follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at Undisclosed Pod, and on Facebook, just search for Undisclosed Podcast. On behalf of the Undisclosed team, and yes, John Cryer, thank you so much. I'm Rebecca Lavoie, signing off for now.